Welcome to Text Messages. These recommendations for teen readers are produced by ReadWriteThink.org, a partnership between the National Council of Teachers of English and the International Reading Association. This is episode 60 of Text Messages, a conversation with Chris Crutcher. I'm your host, Jennifer Bueller. If you follow young adult literature, you know that Chris Crutcher is one of our most respected and beloved YA authors. For 30 years, he's been writing honest books for teenagers, books that tell the truth about people's lives and their struggles. Because of this steadfast commitment to truth-telling, Chris's books are treasured by his readers. They offer insight and wisdom, and they let teens in pain know that they are not alone. But telling the truth also means that Chris and his books are a lightning rod for controversy. Critics call his novels vulgar, offensive, and anti-Christian. His website lists the details of 35 censorship challenges between 1995 and 2011, and those are just the cases that have been reported. Chris is routinely attacked for using profanity and for writing about sex, violence, and racism. His name appears near the top of the American Library Association's list of most frequently challenged authors of the 21st century. Despite these continuing battles, Chris maintains his commitment to writing what's real. You'll hear him talk about why he refuses to tone down his approach later in this episode. But first, let me say a bit more about what readers can always find in a Chris Crutcher book. First, there's a strong main character, usually an athlete, who speaks his or her mind and isn't afraid to stand up for what's right. There's also an adult, often a teacher or a coach, who helps the main character wrestle with difficult questions about life and living. And there's a small-town setting where, despite what people think they know about each other, individuals are coping with forms of trauma that others right in their midst can't or won't see. What unites all of Chris's stories is their focus on exploring how people suffer and how they find the courage and strength to heal. In writing this way, Chris draws on his experience as a family therapist specializing in abuse and neglect, but he lightens the intensity of his stories with humor. Because they are funny, raw, and honest, Chris's books speak to teen readers of all kinds. They've also been recognized time and again by award committees. For significant and lasting contributions to the field of young adult literature, Chris has been honored with both the Margaret A. Edwards Award, given by the American Library Association, and the Allen Award, given by the Assembly on Literature for Adolescents of NCTE. I had the opportunity to interview Chris Crutcher last November at the National Council of Teachers of English annual convention in Las Vegas, Nevada. In this episode, you'll hear excerpts from that interview. Chris will talk about the ideas behind his newest book, Period 8, his thoughts on writing in honest language for teenagers, and what readers have told him about the impact of his stories. I began our conversation by asking Chris to talk about Period 8. In a reader's note in the front of the advanced reader's copy, Chris wrote that readers will find a familiar Crutcher book with familiar Crutcher characters, but he said he put this one on steroids. I knew when I read Period 8 that the book reminded me of his adult novel, The Deep End, as well as one of his best-known YA titles, Staying Fat for Sarah Burns, because all three books have a strong suspense element. Chris said that thriller effect was exactly what he was going for in Period 8.
It really was. It was influenced by The Deep End. I mean, by a lot, because when I started to sit down and write it, and I got the idea of doing something that I hadn't done for a while, and that people didn't necessarily expect, and so it kind of came in as a thriller mode, and I remembered so much of the craft things that I had to learn writing The Deep End to keep it drawn tight. And one of the other things that I remembered was that in doing that, it takes more editing. We did a lot of back and forth editing because I tend to get wordy, and you can really get in the way of a fast paced book.
I asked Chris to say a little more about what he learned from his editor when he was first figuring out how to write the genre of the thriller.
And so it was a brand new editor. But she had done a lot of work with thrillers and things like that, and she taught me to keep keep the line pulled tight, that you just don't have a very much time to let it lag. And the fastest way in the world to get something like that to lag is to say too much, to say things twice, or to say things you don't really need. Mm-hmm. Because with a thriller, I mean, the plot really does pull it along. You want to like the characters, you want to create characters that people are interested in, but at the end, you're going to have the car chase, so to speak, and you know, off it goes. And when I wrote Sarah Burns was the first of those novels that had that element in it, and it came right after The Deep End. It came after I'd gotten used to telling the story that way, so that my thinking pace was like that. And one of the things that I noticed when I started writing Period 8 was that I had gone back to that other style, and I needed to tighten things up again.
On the surface, Period 8 is a book about lunch. The main character is a classic Crutcher Good kid named Polly Baum. Polly's mentor is a teacher named Bruce Logsdon, who opens up his room during lunch each day so that kids have a place to go to talk. But that talk is not just idle chit-chat. Logs leads these students in discussions about relationships and sex, good and bad, right and wrong. With Logs as their guide, kids in Period 8 discuss their lives with remarkable openness and honesty. But there's one member of the group, a kid named Arnie, who's a little too good to be true. Through hints here and there, we start to sense that there's something about Arnie's character that's not to be trusted. I told Chris that in my notes about Period 8, I wrote that it's a book about evil in our midst. He told me about the source of his idea for Arnie and the seed for his thinking about evil.
One of the big drivers for this story was that before I started writing Period 8, I read Cullen's book about Columbine, and one of the things that really shocked me, and I should know better, but one of the things that really shocked me when I read that book was that about 60% of what we thought about Columbine wasn't true, and so much of that was because we had these beliefs about these kids. They were supposed to be the trench coat mafia. They were supposed to be all these things. Cullen comes, you know, he figures out this. Number one, they were wearing trench coats that day because they had guns under there. And Harris, who was kind of the mover behind the whole thing. I mean, Klebold doesn't do it if there's no Harris, and that's the nature of a good psychopath. Harris is a guy who passes every psychological exam. And the guy comes, you know, everyone his psych exam said, this guy's going places. Look out, here he comes. And it's said in a positive way. Well, a good psychopath takes a look at that and says, that's really cool that I fooled you, and you're such a dumb, you know, because I fooled you. So I have nothing but disdain for you for believing me, and then I tell you another lie, and I smile. So there's, and that's inherent evil, because it just, we look the wrong way, and they know it. So he's in some ways he's kind of like Sarah Burns' dad, only way worse, because there's malevolence in his intent, and so that was that kind of personality structure was partially driving the book.
Another element that drives the novel is a series of questions about sex, how teens negotiate their sexual identity development and their sexual relationships. There's Polly, in agony at the start of the book because he's cheated on his girlfriend, Hannah, someone he desperately loves. And there's a character named Mary, also known as Virgin Mary, who's struggling with a lot more problems and tensions related to sex than other people realize. Chris talked a bit about Mary's struggle in the story.
The other piece was one that I was just talking about, the vulnerability of a girl who she's smart, she has all these things going on, but really what she has to be is pretty. Really what she has to be is never disappoint daddy, and which also translates into never disappoint whoever my boyfriend is. I have to prove myself, and even though my daddy is gonna slap me to death if I ever have sex, he wants me to be exciting and sensual, so I'm caught. I'm absolutely caught. And when I make the mistake, there's nobody to go tell. So once I've gone to a place where I have nothing but shame, then why not just pile it on? I mean, why not? I'm going to play it out because I can't turn around and I don't know an avenue to go back out and find the real me. I've got to be the pretty me. I got to be the sexy me, but I have to also be the celibate me. And there are a lot of really, really messed up girls who come out of, you know, coming through high school, out into college and things like that, and they get just like slapped in the back of the head when they get out by themselves on their own because they don't know how to act.
Well, Period 8 is definitely a thriller. It's just as much an exploration of morality. Many of the lunchtime discussions revolve around issues of faithfulness and cheating, how we as people struggle with our base impulses, and how at our core we're driven by biology. We make mistakes. Chris was adamant that in this book and in life, those mistakes are essential to our learning.
And for me, so much of what we do, I mean, we spend so much time pretending that we're a different animal than we are, that we're not run by our biology to a great degree, that the moral thing to do is to override it, and yet our brain power is, as adolescents, our brain power isn't, we aren't cooked yet. I mean, we really don't have one of the reasons we have so much trouble with, you know, making sense with adolescents is because their brain isn't developed enough to have what we're saying make sense. And it's getting there, and certainly we want as much interaction that brings them to that place. But Polly's explanation of the night that it happens is, I mean, when he's talking to his teacher and he says, did you ever have sex with somebody that you didn't want to do? I didn't want to do it. And then he honors the fact that at one point it didn't matter. The biology just took over. But his resistance coming in and the awful feeling going out were real. And they were the part of, they were the thing that would later give him a moral structure. And he had his dad, you know, so he knew not to, that ain't my model, I like my dad, but he shouldn't be doing that stuff. And he knew the effect on him. He's a smart kid. He's pretty developed mentally. He's pretty developed. But that stuff is, I mean, it is on steroids. It is, I mean, we're a trial and error species that it refuses to celebrate errors. So the very thing that we should be celebrating to say, okay, got it, now we're going to go to this next thing, we call them sins, and we have to hate ourselves for doing them. So we have to get past that to get back to the place where we can respond to that thing that we really don't want to be.
Chris tied that idea about the value of learning from our errors to the great power of reading stories and why reading stories matters.
I mean, that actually goes back to almost everything I write, mm-hmm. because that piece, I think, of not celebrating our mistakes, the one thing we learn from. There is no teacher but experience. There is no teacher but experience. I mean, I can learn, I can memorize things, I can do all of those kinds of things, but I'm not going to learn. You can't make me live my life by telling me what happened to you. The best possibility for that is if you tell me a good enough story, I can get it into my imagination. And your imagination is where words turn into experience. If you can't get them into your imagination, you're not going to really experience them. You can memorize them. You can learn some formulas and things like that. But you have to make the mistake. That's why I like stories so much. The stories I love, I live. They're experiences. The movies I love, I live them. I mean, you're there. I mean, you're brokenhearted in the right places. You're laughing like crazy in the right places, because the movie, the story has gotten into your imagination, and all of a sudden you're a participant. And that's what, in the best of worlds, that's what you want your story to be.
As I said earlier in this show, the stories Chris writes are often raw. They're written in raw language about raw topics. Chris's commitment to writing honestly, using honest teen language, often lands him in hot water. I asked him to talk about how he thinks about language in his books, and why he argues that strong language, including liberal use of the F-bomb, is necessary in order to tell a good story.
That language is number one, it's real. It's somebody, I think, from Scholastic at one point, an editor from Scholastic told me that the best definition that he had seen of that word was a meaningless intensifier. It's a beautiful description of what that word is, because it doesn't have anything to do with sex. Nobody, I mean, it doesn't have anything to do with that. And it's a, you know, it's a staccato word. And it you can use it for any part of speech. I mean, it is like the Michael Jordan of words. And so that language, there's an intensity to it, and then there's this common usage thing, and you can see it. I mean, when I use it a lot, you know. I mean, just it's just the language of of adolescence, but it's also the language of adults. I mean, I love the way that we call it adult language. And well, I don't know, I hear it a lot more with kids than I do with adults. But most of the people I know, I mean, all the social workers. And when I was a therapist, one of the things I used to say to kids when they came into my office is, the inside of my office is the same as the inside of your mind and the inside of your heart. And I got to hear it all, and I got to hear it exactly the way you want to tell it. And if somebody's talking to me about their life in that language, there's a pretty good chance I'm going to respond in that same language, because number one, there's a congruence to that, and it makes them feel safe. They don't have to worry about that. They don't have to worry about. They can really tell what it's like, and that it is the language of. It's the language of desperation. It's the language of assault. And you can't tell a good story, I think, without using it.
Chris went on to explain that feedback from his readers continues to affirm to him that he's making the right choice in writing the way he does. Through reader mail, he learns again and again that stories can change people's lives. Reading them can help people learn, and telling them can help people heal.
If they wanted me to, I could paper their room with emails and letters that tell you exactly why you use that language. And talk about those issues. I mean, not just kids who have gone through those things, but kids who become a little more aware of who's around them and the pain that those people are in. I mean, there's an understanding sometimes. And I don't know how long it lasts. I mean, they're adolescents. It's, you know, it'll have a big impact, and then they go on to the next thing. But it's in there. And I get letters all the time from people who read my books 10 years ago or 15 years ago and said, you know, this thing took me on a path, and I just want to let you know. So one of those letters is worth probably a whole bunch of those experiences. And I feel blessed that I was I've lived this life in a place where I didn't have to have those things happen to me, but I was really privy to how they work. And how people, I mean, when I started working in abuse and neglect, my whole idea of a hero changed, because people were standing up under stuff that would have buckled me. That, and you know, guys that had done things to their kids that you'd just be horribly ashamed of, and somehow they're going to get their family back together. They're going to make it happen. And it means they have to eat shit to do it. They have to say what they did in front of other people. They have to talk about, you know, what a horrible guy I am or I was and what I learned and all that. And it's healing. It is healing. Telling the truth is healing. It's rugged territory.
I hope you will read these books and recommend them to the teens in your life. Each title should be available at your local library or bookstore. Remember that no book is right for every reader, so preview books for appropriate reading level and content before passing them on to your teen. Next month, I'll be back to bring you a show on Latino literature for teens. In honor of El Día de los Niños, an American Library Association initiative that emphasizes the importance of literacy for all children from all backgrounds, I'll introduce you to works of fiction and nonfiction that explore the lives and experiences of people from Spanish-speaking cultures. Until next time, I'm Jennifer Bueller. More episodes of Text Messages are available at readwritethink.org/textmessages. You can listen to our elementary book podcast, Chatting About Books, at readwritethink.org/chattingaboutbooks. Text Messages is supported by the Verizon Foundation through thinkfinity.org and produced monthly by the National Council of Teachers of English and the International Reading Association. Music in this podcast is courtesy of Scott Andrew. Thanks for listening, and look forward to more Text Messages soon.